Well, the thing about white supremacy is it is a viral toxin. The fact that there are little or no consequences for the violence raining down on Black folk is what becomes this spur to vigilante violence. That kind of vigilante violence is endemic in the United States. That is what is so frightful and perilous about this time that we're in right now.
Episode 87 of the Refuse Fascism podcast. This podcast is brought to you by volunteers with Refuse Fascism. I'm Sam Goldman, one of those volunteers and host of the show. Refuse Fascism exposes, analyzes, and stands against the very real danger and threat of fascism coming to power in this country. In today's episode, we're sharing a conversation I had with Dr. Carol Anderson, author of The Second, Race and Guns in a Fatally Unequal America. We spoke November 23rd, shortly after the Kyle Rittenhouse verdict, but before the verdict was announced on the killers of Ahmaud Arbery. I want to remind listeners that in just 3 days, the pro-fascist majority Supreme Court of the United States will hear a direct challenge to Roe. On Wednesday, December 1st, the Supreme Court will hear Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization, where the state of Mississippi had specifically asked the court to overrule Roe v. Wade. The Mississippi's law bans abortion after 15 weeks, with no exception for rape or incest, and makes abortion illegal 2 months before a fetus becomes viable. If they rule in favor of the Mississippi abortion ban, the constitutional right to abortion will be overturned, immediately made illegal in almost half the country, in states that already have trigger bans in effect. What needs to be heard outside the Supreme Court of the United States and nationwide is this: abortion on demand and without apology. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. It's not hyperbole to say that the future of abortion access hangs in the balance. To understand why, to get more background on this case, what's at stake, and its connection to the whole fascist onslaught, I encourage folks to go back and check out 2 episodes from earlier this fall, episode 82, When Is It Time to Break the Law?, and episode 78 on the abortion rights emergency. And most importantly, take action that makes clear our refusal to surrender, to go back, and also makes clear how essential abortion really is. Listeners in Chicago, on Wednesday, rally at Federal Plaza, starting at 5 p.m. Listeners in Seattle, noon, Westlake Ave, North, and Denny Way, there's a Refuse Fascism protest taking place. See strikeforchoice.org for nationwide actions. And in D.C., everyone that can get there driving distance, the Center for Reproductive Rights is holding a rally outside the Supreme Court of the United States at 8 a.m. The New York City Revolution Club is having people gather outside the Supreme Court at 11 a.m. And the Women's March is holding the line for abortion rights, calling on folks to meet up at Columbus Circle at 1 p.m., then marching over to surround the Supreme Court. Know of other actions for us to boost? Please tag us on social media. Visit refusefascism.org to get signs, banners, and flyers to bring into these actions to help make them as powerful as they can be. And donate $15 this Giving Tuesday, and you'll get 100 abortion on demand without apology stickers. So be sure to hit that donate button while you're there. Okay, so back to today's interview. Right now, we are on the heels of 3 high-stakes trials that concentrate the looming threat of fascist mobs and threats of violence unleashed to build this fascist movement and consolidate power. Trial 1. Kyle Rittenhouse is, as folks listening know, a cowardly racist punk who traveled to Kenosha, Wisconsin in 2020 with an AR-15 and joined other fascist gunmen, confronting protesters under the guise of, quote-unquote, protecting private property. When 2 unarmed people encountered him, he shot them both dead with the assault rifle. On Friday, November 19th, a jury declared him not guilty and let him walk free. This ruling gave a green light to more slaughter of Black people and anyone who would stand up for their lives. Trial 2, Travis McMichael, Gregory McMichael, and William Bryan were convicted of murder. These three hunted down and murdered Ahmaud Arbery for the crime, quote unquote, of being Black and jogging through a white neighborhood. Remember, these three were told to go home and shower by the police who came to the scene to, quote unquote, investigate. They were the ones who videotaped the whole thing from the time they jumped into their pickup truck until they gunned him down. And they went free for months until public outcry and mass struggle finally forced a trial. But in the end, they were found guilty. Rightly and righteously so. I wanted to underscore one point, that this lynching was swept under the rug until weeks of local protests were joined by an unprecedented nationwide uprising against white supremacy. In the face of this growing fascist movement with its roots in the Confederacy and Klan terror, it's clear that people's power is in the streets. Trial 3. The lead organizers of the 2017 quote-unquote Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, were sued in federal court. Remember, this is the rally that drew thousands of white supremacists and Nazis, where they marched with torches like a lynch mob, where they chanted, "Jews will not replace us," where they brutally beat anti-racist protesters and Black people. Remember, this was the quote-unquote rally that culminated when a Nazi drove his car into a crowd of peaceful protesters, sending bodies flying through the air and murdering Heather Heyer. All of this 21st century violence to quote-unquote defend a statue of a 19th century Confederate general built by 20th century segregationists. A jury returned a mixed decision, clearing the white supremacists of federal violations, but holding them liable under state law. They ruled that the organizers must pay $26 million. To me, the fact that the jury could not decide against them using the federal KKK Act of 1871, even as cluckers marched amongst them in full white robes, makes it clear that the law is at best insufficient to take on the fascist threat on any level, although the payout does provide a taste of justice. There's a history behind all of this. That's what we're going to get into today. Where does this all come from, and how does this all relate to a fascist offensive that involves a whole movement that attempted a violent coup on January 6th to overturn an election? The GOP, which has since purged itself of anyone who disagrees. It's deepened and hardened the belief of millions in their fascist base that this violence was righteous and may be necessary again. How does this all fit together? Where is this all going? Where does it come from? Where do we go from here? To talk about all this, I am honored to be chatting with Dr. Carol Anderson. Dr. Carol Anderson is the Charles Howard Candler Professor and Chair of African American Studies at Emory University and the author of White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. She's also the author of One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy, and her latest book, The Second, Race and Guns in a Fatally Unequal America. That's the book we'll mainly focus on today. It's a brilliant piece that everyone who's wondering what's going on here with these cases that I described, what's happening with January 6th, insurrectionists walking free, and the larger backdrop of a coming civil war, this is a key text to go to help make sense of it. So let's have a listen. Thank you, Dr. Anderson, for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I know that you've been talking about it a lot, but I do want to start with this because it's what's on people's minds. Many people have rightfully contrasted the numerous cases of unarmed young Black men or even Black children who have been murdered by police or vigilantes to Kyle Rittenhouse, who not only was allowed to roam the streets of Kenosha with an AR-15, but was just acquitted for gunning down people protesting there, resulting in the deaths of two people, as I said earlier, and maiming a third. For example, 12-year-old Tamir Rice, who was playing with a toy gun in a park in Cleveland before being shot to death by a police officer, Trayvon Martin, who was assaulted and shot to death by a neighborhood vigilante. Both of them claimed that they felt threatened by these unarmed children. Many people have also rightfully compared the Rittenhouse scenario to a fictional alternate, predicting a Black teenager who attempted to confront right-wing protesters with an AR-15, that he would not have survived that encounter, much less been acquitted after shooting anyone. I was hoping that you could talk a little bit about what the Rittenhouse case reveals about the right to self-defense and the right to bear arms.
Thank you so much. So one of the things that I've really laid out in my book, The Second, was the deep anti-Blackness that courses through this nation. And that was part and parcel of the crafting of the Second Amendment. And we get the narrative, the NRA narrative of the Second Amendment as being bedrock foundational to American citizenship, that it is the thing that is there to stop domestic tyranny, that it is the thing that is your bedrock right. What we have to understand about the Second is that it was a bribe to the South to get the South to buy into the United States of America. When the Constitutional Ratification Convention was happening in Virginia, James Madison had put control of the militia under federal control and had done that because the militia had proven that it was absolutely unreliable in the war for independence. Sometimes they'd show up, sometimes they wouldn't. Sometimes they fight, sometimes they would take off running. So it was this thing about how do we have this militia and have this militia do what we need to do when we can't rely upon it. And so Madison had put it under federal control. The slave owners in Virginia were absolutely apoplectic about that. You had Patrick Henry and George Mason arguing strenuously that you could not trust the federal government to send in the militia when there would be a slave revolt. George Mason was like, we will be left defenseless. And it was like, because you know, under the federal government, you've got those folks in Pennsylvania and in Massachusetts who have been rolling back slavery in their own borders. We can't rely upon them to defend us. We will be left defenseless. And so it's important to understand that this Second Amendment, which was what George Mason had required, he had required a Bill of Rights put in the Constitution. And that was the way to keep the South from organizing for a new constitutional convention, because Madison was afraid it would go back to the old days, open up a Pandora's box and go back to the old days of the Articles of Confederation. How do we save the United States of America? Just like with the Three-Fifths Clause, just like with the 20 additional years of the Atlantic slave trade, just like with the Fugitive Slave Clause that was in the Constitution, now we have the Second Amendment as this bribe to the South to not scuttle the United States of America and to do so on the back of enslaving Black people. And to do so, understanding the militia is part and parcel of this ongoing anti-Blackness of defining Black people as the default threat in American society, as those who the white community has to be protected against. And the way that you provide that protection is via the militia, is via determining who has access to guns and who does not, determining who legitimately can claim self-defense and who cannot. Because Black folks in this narrative do not have the right to self-defense. And that came out of a Virginia law in the 1600s, I believe it was, that made it clear that if a white person hits somebody Black, either enslaved or a free Black, that Black person does not have the right to strike back. And so you begin to see how foundational these themes are that are carrying through into our modern day. And so I look at, for instance, Trayvon Martin. When you see the Trayvon Martin story, what you had in that legal proceeding was to cut off the entire narrative of how George Zimmerman had the gun, how George Zimmerman said, oh, and they always get away, how George Zimmerman stalked an unarmed child through that neighborhood. And only in the judge's instructions to the jury, only to look at that confrontation and to see that you had this big Black scary guy threatening poor pudgy George Zimmerman. What was George to do? It is that same narrative that you get where they cut off Kyle Rittenhouse's origin story. So you don't get the being at the CVS and saying, ah, I really want to, you know, put a couple of bullets in them for looting. You don't see the rest of the story about the illegally obtained AR-15. You don't get the story about how he inserted himself in the midst of a protest about a Black man being shot in the back 7 times. By the police. You don't get that. You don't get that these were folks protesting injustice. Instead, the judge rules that you cannot call them victims. You can call them rioters, looters. but not victims. And you get that you don't see the initial killing because of the problem of pixelation by expanding the screen so that you get a better view, to not call in a technological expert on that, but instead to rely upon this judge who was talking about the text messages that he gets and his ability to handle text messages. And so you see that you get this very narrowed sense of who has the right to bear arms, who has the right to defend themselves. And I hear folks say, yeah, but the folks that he killed were white, that Rittenhouse killed were white. Whites who believe that Black folks, that their lives matter, whites who fight for Black citizenship rights, they are in the crosshairs. That is a consistent theme. We see it in 1837 with Elijah Lovejoy, who was an abolitionist, and his newspaper kept getting attacked. They kept burning down his building, messing up his presses. He kept having to rebuild. And finally, he got sick and doggone tired of it. And he's like, the next time they come, I'm ready. And so he had a gun. Well, the mob got to him first and killed him. Now, they were found not guilty. So arsonists and killers are found not guilty because you have a white man who believes that slavery is wrong. You begin to also think about Mickey Schwerner and Andrew Goodman in Freedom Summer in Mississippi. Mickey Schwerner was the first one killed by the Klan in Neshoba County, Mississippi. They put a bullet in him immediately. The anger that there would be somebody white who could believe that Black people have citizenship, that Black people are human. It is in this system of white supremacy. It is anathema. It is the penultimate. It is heresy. It is blasphemy. It is going against the way, the hierarchy, the way that things should be. And it is a way to signal to whites, stay in your place.
Thank you for that, Dr. Anderson. I mean, one of my favorite parts of your book was learning all the stories that we aren't told. I knew about the attacks, let's say, on more recent history, the Freedom Riders that were white, but going back and looking at the rebellions that took place and white people that supported in some way offering any kind of support to these rebellions of slaves and how they were deemed equivalent as the slave because they identified a human being as being a human being.
It becomes a false narrative that race had nothing to do with the Kyle Rittenhouse killing those men and wounding the third one, because that was a Black Lives Matter protest. And what we have seen in this nation, so think about the difference between the way that the Black Lives Matter protest was handled in DC, where Trump had called out all kinds of federal officials, even those that weren't identified or by their names or what unit they were with, violating law, and the tear gas that was just raining down on these folks. Juxtapose that to the invasion of the Capitol on January 6th, where the message goes out, we will not be able to contain this, but let it happen. Yeah, let it happen. And when we see that when Ashley Babbitt, who was breaking into a federal building to overthrow an election, a duly free and fair election, to basically stage a coup, and you had an officer shoot her, what you see from the right wing is to lionize her and make her a hero, make her a martyr for trying to overthrow the U.S. government. And let me back up to say that part of what we're seeing in that is the delegitimization of Black people. So when you have a Newt Gingrich say they stole the election in Milwaukee, that is a city that has a lot of Black folk. They stole the election in Detroit, yet another city with a lot of Black folk. They stole the election in Atlanta, yet another city with a lot of Black folks, saying if these Black folks did not vote for a white supremacist, then this election was not legitimate. Therefore, it must be overturned. And so that invasion that you saw was about delegitimizing the votes of folk of color.
I think that it's very helpful the way that you are threading these together, because I think for some people, they see the hypocrisy, they see the difference in treatment, but they don't see the commonality that's at the center of all of them. And that's the center of white rage, of white supremacy, of, in my opinion, people have been talking a lot about, is the Second Amendment trumping the First Amendment? There's a lot of language around that. And I've been feeling like, let's stop, let's wait a second here. It's about who and it's about what.
It is about power. And it is about taking away power from anybody who is not a white Christian male. It's a very particular thing. And if you don't fit in that, then who do the guns go to? Maybe it's not true. So I'm always cautious about I saw on social media type things. But I believe that before jury deliberations began, there were Black folks in Georgia armed, walking. I don't think that's the kinds of Second Amendment right that they're going for. It's gun rights for a very certain section of people. The people who were out in the Capitol, their gun rights are protected. But whose voting rights are on the line? Whose right to protest is on the line? It has everything to do with power and, in my opinion, with fascism. Creating a certain section of people that are subhuman. The Trumpers and all those who follow him are really, as Toni Norman, who was a guest on the show a little while back, was saying, you know, these are people that are going back.
It's one of the things that I wrote in the new epilogue for White Rage, you know, because I smelled Trump coming in that first version of White Rage. I smelled him as the antithesis, as the response to Obama's election. And when Obama becomes the scary Black man, it begins to tell you how deeply entrenched this anti-Blackness is in American society. And so the response to Obama is the un-Obama, which is Donald Trump. And what Hillary said in her campaign was, we are stronger together, which meant then that there were enough resources in American society where we could all benefit. What Trump offered was a neo-apartheid state, which was a state where you would have a vast rightless labor pool made up overwhelmingly of folks of color, and you would have whites in there, except there would be the allure that in this neo-apartheid state, all of those resources that are generated by this vast rightless labor pool would eddy up to that strata of whites. But it is a small strata of whites in this system. And that is what Trump put on the line. And that is what fed into the fury and the violence, fed into Tucker Carlson talking about replacement theory, fed into the rise of vigilante justice, the storming of the Capitols. Remember in Michigan, where you had this group coming in with their rifles into the state capitol, overlooking the legislature as the legislature is trying to do its business. You had the plot against the governor to kidnap the governor and hold her on trial. Wow. This was basically a prelude to what happened on January 6th, where they were hunting down Mike Pence and they were hunting down Nancy Pelosi because they would not do the ultimate right wing's bidding and overturn an election and install Donald Trump as president for life.
I wanted to ask your opinion on whether you feel like this movement that we're talking about, the GOP as it stands today, would you use the word fascist to apply to it? Is this the same old, going back to the nation's origins? Or do you think that there's anything new, you know, akin to a movement that's aiming at eliminating the rule of law and democratic and civil rights? How do you see that?
When I look at the Southern strategy, which was really came into the fore during Nixon's campaign for presidency, and what you had there was the Southern Democrats, who were the group that hated civil rights, and that the Southern Democrats were like, we cannot be in a party that believes that Black people have rights and is putting the federal government behind the exercise of Black people's rights as American citizens. And so you had the Republican Party look up and going, ooh, we can finally break the solid Democratic South and we can get the number of conservative votes in order to move forward our conservative agenda. And to me, just like the conservatives in Weimar Germany, who looked at Hitler and said, ooh, we can use Hitler's group and Hitler's status in order to create the coalition that we need in order to quash the socialists and the communists who are in our Reichstag. We can do that and we can control them. Well, the thing about white supremacy is it is a viral toxin. It is all powerful. And when the conservatives brought that toxin of the Southern Democrats into the Republican Party, it took over. It moved the moderate Republicans out, silenced them. And it also then led to the base being just turned up, fueled on this fear, this anger, this hatred, fueled on it. And so it required then that those who were in the GOP primary had to speak to that base, that energized base, which continued to move the party further and further to the right. So when you think about the insurrection, and you think about the big lie that this election was stolen, and the way that Republicans have tried to downplay the insurrection. Oh, this was just a tourist visit. Wow. The way that they have blocked subpoenas, the way that they have blocked the investigation, a full-blown investigation and an unveiling of this, juxtapose that to Watergate, where you in fact had Republicans who were absolutely appalled at what the Nixon administration had done and said, oh, we cannot abide by this. When you have Barry Goldwater going into Nixon saying, no, son, you got to go. We cannot do this. You will not have the votes in the Senate to survive an impeachment. And Barry Goldwater was the one who helped with the Southern strategy because of his belief that Brown versus Board was unconstitutional, his belief that the Civil Rights Act violated basic states' rights. So Barry Goldwater is no flaming liberal, but he was like, under this line, I will not go. We have yet to see that in this current version of the Republican Party. There is no line under which they will not go. The rule of law does not matter. Democracy is the enemy. That is what is so frightful and perilous about this time that we're in right now.
I really, really agree. I wanted to shift back to something that we kind of touched on earlier in the conversation. I wanted to talk about the federal law versus states' rights, because it's something that is in your book, The Second, and something that I think really relates to a few cases that are happening right now. The slave states demanded the Fugitive Slave Act in 1850 occur because the supremacy of federal law, as you talk about in the second, required non-slave states to recognize and quote unquote honor their right to retrieve their quote unquote property in human beings anywhere in the US. Today, fascists in office demand the supremacy of federal law when it comes to overturning any prohibition on concealed carry. And now you have the New York case attempting to overturn any state or municipality's attempts to regulate the individual's right to bear arms anywhere they want.
Yes.
But when it comes to stripping people of their basic civil rights, states' rights must prevail. Like, I think about Texas and SB 8, the abortion ban that denies what has been recognized as a right by the Supreme Court of the United States, and dozens of states are suppressing their citizens' rights to vote. So there's a long history to this apparent conflict, and I was wondering what your thoughts are on this.
This sophistry is what it is. It's situational. So it's like, when I need the federal government to do my bidding, I'm all for federal power. When I don't want to do the federal government's bidding, then I'm all for states' rights. As you noted, you had the slave states demanding, bullying, ending up with the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, which said that any state had to provide support for slave owners to come and retrieve their property, their runaway slaves. And if the state refused, the state then had to pay the slave owner out of the state's treasury for that lost property. So either way, the northern state had to provide resources to uphold slavery and human bondage. And the states were bristling at this. And you had the South just strolling around going, yeah, look, we can really go get them now. And I look at that moment, I talk about the Battle of Christiana in the book, where you had a slave owner named Edward Gorsuch out of Maryland who goes up to Pennsylvania to retrieve his property. And he has a U.S. Marshal with him, as well as his son and his nephew. And they go to Christiana and they knock on a man named William Parker's door, saying, I've come to get my property. Now, Parker was a fugitive slave himself, but they had set up a self-defense community in Christiana. And when Gorsuch started getting really just, I come to get my property, and Parker was like, "You, there's nothing here that you own. That chair is not yours." I mean, so think about the humanity in Parker to say, there is nothing here that you own. And the response was Gorsuch was ready to get it on. Gorsuch ended up dying there in Christiana. And you had in this really weird moment, because a white man named Castor Hanway, who was in that group of those in the Defenders, he was charged with treason. So think about that. Those who defy the Fugitive Slave Act, that is like a war against the United States, charged with treason. And thank God you had a judge who was like, nah, this was a self-defense community. This was self-defense. This was not treason. And Hanway was found not guilty. The South felt violated by that. That, you know, we want the federal law to uphold this. Remember, earlier on, they fought to ensure when Benjamin Franklin came in with a petition saying that Congress would have the right to regulate and end slavery, that the South rose up and did its first filibuster, even before they knew what a filibuster was, and bullying folks, going, you do not have that right. And if anybody tries to take my property, they will be in danger, mortal danger. So you get this sophistry here where it's like we like federal law when it is about the violation of a people's rights. We don't like federal law when federal law is about honoring citizenship rights, honoring the human rights, honoring the humanity of the folks who live within our borders. So when federal law says you are an American citizen, and as an American citizen, these are the array of rights that you have, and the state is like, no, you don't. You are a citizen of Mississippi. You are a citizen of Alabama. You are a citizen of Georgia, and your rights are therefore conscribed, and the feds do not have the right to step in. And think about the way Texas has SB 8. It allows for basic vigilantes to police women who are exercising their reproductive rights.
Yeah, I mean, the growth of vigilantism that people are seeing, and rightly shocked that at this point in time, we have people in Texas hunting down abortion providers, hunting down aunties who gave their nieces some money to get an abortion. You know, like, it's insane. And this is part of the same vicious, violent, revenge-fueled movement that is hunting down and killing Black folks. Turning to the Arbery case, which I consider to be a modern day lynching straight up. They lynched a man and then they lynched his character in court. The disgusting verbiage that came out of the defense attorney in the McMichael trial, people should have nothing but contempt for. There's a history in this country of lawless vigilantism under the guise of law and order. And this is something that you speak to in your book. And I think that it's very helpful for us to kind of ground ourselves in this. You know, I was listening to the closing argument, as I'm sure you did, in the McMichael's murder trial. That's the trial of the murders of Ahmaud. And they were leaning heavily on this. Neighbors were helping neighbors to deal with this wave of burglaries, you know, because the police weren't able to apprehend them. And this is the same argument that resulted, in my opinion, in Rittenhouse's acquittal. He was there to protect the community, protect private property over people, right? And was forced to defend himself against these rioters and looters. And, you know, I was hoping that you could touch on the history and roots of where this sort of murderous vigilantism under the guise of law and order, where that comes from in American history.
I see it coming out of basically the slave patrols, where at a certain point in South Carolina's history, basically every white person was deputized as a member of the slave patrol to be able to have the right to question somebody Black. Why aren't you in your place? What are you doing out here? And let me see your papers. Who are you? Who do you belong to? That kind of white gives right. And so when you think about how Travis McMichael said, well, he wouldn't stop and answer my questions, as if Travis McMichael had the right to question why Ahmaud Arbery was running, jogging in that neighborhood, that Ahmaud Arbery did not have the right to refuse to answer this man who had been harassing him by following him in this pickup truck and cutting him off. That is the sense of whites have the right to control Black bodies. They have the right to demand and get an acceptable answer for the whites who are asking the question. That sense of whites have the right, we see carrying through to the Atlanta race massacre in 1906, where under the guise of protecting the white community, protecting white women from these black rapist beasts, and this had been the press and the politicians who were running for governor stoking the fears and the flames that there were just mass rapes happening, that no white woman was safe because of all of these black men. And so you had whites forming vigilante mobs and hunting down black people and just killing them left and right. You had the same kind of sense that, you know, we've got to get these black folks under control in Red Summer 1919, where you had, like in Washington, D.C., white mobs attacking black folks under the guise of putting black folks back in their place because they were acting like they were equal. They were doing things like looking at white women. We have to protect our community. You see the same kind of language happening in Tulsa when Black Tulsa is wiped out. The same kind of thing about we have to protect our community. We see it in Groveland, Florida in 1948. And you saw today that the four Black men who were convicted of rape were finally exonerated. When Groveland burned down, it was the same, we've got to protect our community. That kind of vigilante violence is endemic in the United States. And what makes it endemic? You go back to the rise of Jim Crow, where you would have a lynching on average every other day for 3 decades. Begin to think about the terror that rains down on the Black community, knowing that that kind of violence is happening and that law enforcement is not there to protect you. And that's where this conjoins, is that you get this violence and this nation of laws does not value the laws that protect Black people. So now I go to Ahmaud Arbery laying this out. Remember that that video was readily available immediately. The cops saw it. 2 DAs saw it. And 1 DA wrote a long, long brief about why this killing was justifiable. It took protest to make that video public. And when it became public, that's when you began to see some movement. You did not have the kind of coddling, that kind of legal justification for an unjustified killing. The fact that there are little or no consequences for the violence raining down on Black folk is what becomes this spur to vigilante violence. And the assault on the Capitol was vigilante violence. And the fact that there haven't been real consequences to that violence puts this democracy and the people in it at risk, at serious risk.
I really appreciate what all that you were laying out. And I think that people really need to shake off whatever denial they have, discomfort that they have, and really take a sober look at not only the history, but the current reality and danger. Part of, in my opinion, confronting this is you were talking about the white supremacy being endemic. I've heard you speak and talk about the genesis of the Second Amendment, the genesis of these laws. It is white supremacy. And so you have to confront that. And I think that it's pivotal. And if we look at it with clear eyes and we see a situation in which the very foundation and fabric of this nation is totally interwoven with and inseparable, in my opinion, from white supremacy in a nation whose wealth continuing to this day stems from Black people being property. And I think that people need to look at it at a system that continues to perpetuate and be fueled by and fuel white supremacy. And because people are rightly outraged, I wanted to get your opinion on something that we see in the movement as important, which is nonviolence. In this movement being Refuse Fascism. Sorry, that wasn't clear to the listeners. You're a historian. You know, your work documents and analyzes deep roots of racism in this country. And our role as ordinary folks who want to uproot that racism have a lot of work to do. To me, it starts with understanding what we're up against.
Yeah.
But we also need to act. Yeah. And Refuse Fascism, we've consistently argued that we need massive nonviolent protests. on the lines of the Beautiful Rising that swept the country last year after George Floyd was murdered so cruelly, as an example of how a whole conversation can be changed and a sliver of justice can be won through massive determined protest that doesn't stop. Now, some have argued, since we are still seeing people being murdered by police at the same or worse rates than ever before, and since the fascists have now been given a green light to murder, that our side needs to stop being nonviolent. To me, this isn't just an ethical stand. It's about a blueprint for prevailing. I think about how a massive determined protest can make space for everyone to participate and rely on our courage for others to join us. I feel like we're in a moment where that actually does matter. But I was wondering what your thoughts or comments on it, because, you know, my friend Coco, who's an editor for Refuse Fashions, who's writing about We Need a Beautiful Rising and talking about nonviolence and all these comments about we need to stop being nonviolent. And I was wondering, as a historian, what advice would you give people around this?
It is both strategic and practical. The practical side is that you can never match the violence that the state can rain down. The state's access to weaponry, to the tools of violence, are just, you know, and so I think about at Selma after Bloody Sunday, and Andrew Young talked about, there were folks who were like, I'm sick of this, I'm getting my gun. And Young was like, okay, you had to talk them down. You had to say, okay, so what kind of gun you got? And they talk, well, yeah, I got a 22. And they're like, okay, have you seen that shotgun that they have? You know what a shotgun can do? And then he's like, okay, so how many do you have? And they're like, he was like, okay, so you know, you got the whole Alabama State Patrol out there. You've got Sheriff Jim Clark's folks, and you know, they'll call in the National Guard. Can your weaponry match what they have? And so practically, we know that this state is armed. So I'm going to get my gun is a suicide run. I teach the civil rights movement, and I'm teaching it this semester, actually. And one of the key elements was nonviolence. That language of nonviolence and the nonviolent protest, and I'm going to tie this into Ahmaud Arbery. What that did was it helped short circuit that longstanding narrative as Black people, as criminals, as violent. Because then what you see when you see white folks just going after Black folk, and you're like, well, why were they doing this? You know, they went after them because they were Black. We can't figure out what else is happening here. It was just because they were Black. Then it begins to shift the narrative. And so I think about the prosecuting attorney's closing arguments on Ahmaud Arbery. She said he didn't have a weapon. He didn't even have a cell phone. All he had were his running shorts. The reason they went after him is because there was a Black man running through their neighborhood. That was jarring. Absolutely jarring. Because what we know is that in this society that is so steeped in anti-Blackness, it is that it makes it easy to say, well, you know, he had a gun. Well, you know, he was a druggie. Well, you know, as the way to justify the systemic violence that is raining down on folk. And what we also know, when we imagine the kind of society that we want to live in, that we want to raise our kids in, that we want our neighbors to be in, it is not a community steeped in violence. It is a community that has rethought what safety and security really looks like, that has rethought what humanity really looks like, that values real safety and real security, that values real humanity. That does not happen by trying to take on a state that is as well armed as this one. There are almost 400 million guns in private ownership here in the United States. So I'm not even talking about those guns. I'm just talking about the state guns.
Yeah, I think it makes sense why people are saying, do I need to come to a protest armed when this is happening? My solution is no, we need to stop this fascist danger. We need to get rid of a society in which you have over 74 million people wanting to go back to what they think is friggin' antebellum greatness. We need to get rid of that. And you don't get rid of that by going gun to gun with a violent, genocidally racist movement who has the full backing of the state. You don't do that. I'm not saying that violence is never warranted or there isn't such thing as self-defense and all those things. Let me be clear on that. People have a right to defend themselves, obviously. I just guide people back to Dr. Anderson's work and who gets to have that right and who's going to be put in most jeopardy, and it's going to be Black folks. So people should just be cognizant of those things when they start saying this crap. I wanted to close out, you know, we've talked a lot about how deeply rooted white supremacy is in the foundation of the country, right down to the Constitution itself. In a recent article that you wrote for The Guardian, you wrote, quote, "The nation has a really bad habit of letting white supremacy get away with repeated attempts to murder American democracy. It's time to break that habit. If we don't, they just might succeed next time," end quote. And I'm wondering, what gives you hope that we can dismantle this oppression, that we can break this habit?
It's several things. It's the people. After the killing of George Floyd, we had protest movements in 50 states. People saw that and were appalled. It is in the 2020 election, in the midst of a pandemic where hundreds of thousands of Americans had been killed. You had the highest voter turnout, record-breaking turnout, because people understood that democracy was at stake, that what Trump was bringing was the destruction of American democracy. Because if he didn't have to worry about re-election, Lord, Katie, bar the door. That was so clear about what the plan was. So here in Georgia, you had folks saying, I will stand in line to vote for 12 hours to make sure that I have done all that I can do to fight for this democracy. When it's really clear what's at stake, the people rise up and they make clear that they want a vibrant, multiracial, multiethnic, multireligious democracy. They don't want what Michael Flynn was talking about, this one Christian nation under one religion, one God. No. So my hope is in the people.
Well, Dr. Anderson, we share that hope. Even though my listeners know, I think that we can't talk about democracy without talking about that there's never been democracy for all in this country. So we need something very different. But I definitely agree that what gives me a lot of hope is the people, and that they're not all powerful. They are weak in the sense that they are afraid and very cognizant of our power, if we choose to make it visible. So we don't want to hand these fascists the future. We got to change that. We've got to make it visible. I want to thank Dr. Anderson. Thank you so much for sharing your time, your expertise with us. Folks can be sure to find a link to Dr. Anderson's books through her website in the show notes. And Dr. Anderson, is there anything else that you want to guide people to besides your book, your website?
My website, ProfessorCarolAnderson.org. You will find all of my op-eds on there, as well as my podcasts and TV appearances. And just keep reading and knowing this history and continuing to fight for a better future. That's the thing, to really imagine what we could be. Wow.
Thank you so much, Dr. Anderson.
As we say at the top of every show, this podcast is about exposing, analyzing, and standing against fascism. In this interview, I feel like we did some deep exposure and analysis, but we also touched on how Dr. Anderson's deep insight into what is really meant by the right to bear arms in this country has deep implications for standing against fascism. And I wanted to say a few things about that before we close out. I really appreciate Dr. Anderson's insights in that the way that this country has developed and the way it is now, white supremacy has the guns on its side, the gun laws substantially on its side, and to some extent, their violence even has some level of perceived legitimacy on its side. This gives enormous weight towards our use of nonviolent strategies. I also appreciate what she says about the world that we want to live in not being drenched in violence. Refuse fascism was formed with the goal of nonviolent, sustained mass protest to stop fascism, to drive out the Trump-Pence regime for these reasons and others. And we took and continue to take inspiration from movements around the world that have succeeded in ousting heinous regimes through those means, broadly speaking. That nonviolence was part of the uniting and foundational principles of Refuse Fascism, which you can learn more about at refusefascism.org. At the same time, if we're looking at the nightmare of the world that we live in and taking seriously our responsibility to change it for the better, or even to give future generations a fighting chance to change it. We should be having many more conversations about how we're really going to get free. And this quote from revolutionary leader Babavigian gets to the heart of that conversation, in my opinion. Quote, "Can this system be reformed through a struggle relying solely and as an absolute principle on nonviolence? Or, in fact, is a revolutionary struggle of millions to overthrow this system necessary in order to open the way to eliminating the exploitation, oppression, inequality, and injustice that is built into this system?" End quote. Especially in a moment when there is a real showdown for the future coming to a head, this question is essential to discuss. Again, these are just my thoughts. In that light, on a personal note, I'd like to recommend two resources from the website revcom.us. One is How We Can Win, How We Can Really Make Revolution. And the second is This Is a Rare Time When Revolution Becomes Possible, Why That Is So, and How to Seize on This Rare Opportunity. And that's by Babavigian. So thanks for listening to Refuse Fascism. I want to hear from you. Share your thoughts, questions, ideas for topics or guests. Lend a skill. Tweet me at Sam B. Goldman. Or you can drop me a line at SamanthaGoldman@refusefascism.org or leave a voicemail by calling 917-426-7582. You can also record a voice message by going to anchor.fm/refuse-fascism and clicking the button there. You might even hear yourself on a future episode. Want to support the show? It's simple. Show us some love by rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts or your listening platform of choice. And follow, subscribe, so you never miss an episode. We got some sweet tweets that we wanted to share. One is from Sable. She tweeted us, "Super thankful for this podcast and the clarity it brings, the range of guests, their expertise, and the morality of refused fascism in forever and always refusing to accept fascism in any form." And we got a sweet one from FFH2018 that said, "I too am thankful for all of you and all you do. I appreciate you. I never used to listen to podcasts. Now I don't miss an episode of this one. Always a great informative discussion that fills me more with hope than despair with the fascist threat we face. Thank you." Well, thank you, listeners. And if you feel like they do, Giving Tuesday is just around the corner. Chip in to support our pod and content creation to help people understand and act to stop the fascist threat. You can Venmo refuse-fascism or give via Cash App Refuse Fascism, or donate at refusefascism.org. Hit the donate button. Remember, give a donation of $15 or more, and you'll get 100 Abortion on Demand and Without Apology stickers. While you're there at refusefascism.org, check out our merch at the Refuse Fascism shop, where we now have Refuse Fascism beanies. It's getting cold. Get one on your head. Thanks to Richie Marini, Paul Street, Lena Thorne, and Mark Tinkelman for helping produce this episode. Thanks to incredible volunteers, we have transcripts available for each episode. So be sure to visit refusefascism.org and sign up to get them in your inbox each week. We'll be back next Sunday. Until then, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America.